This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, we'll go ahead and get started in the interest of time. Appreciate everybody being here and settling in. Hope everybody had a great couple of weeks in between our last meeting. But we'll call the meeting for September 17th to order here at 12:16 p.m. Are there any late additions to the agenda? Anything that anyone would like to add from the floor?
So I will say, I'm not sure what copy you have. Amy and I are going to work on a better method for me to not be so confused about how I send out things. But in addition to the budget model presentation today, there is just a quick update regarding the president's address, and then Tanya had a few things around the new business with the printer leave policy. So there is, I printed out some for you there, but you came in before I came in. You might have grabbed one of the older agendas.
And I just have one addition on our new business. I just want to touch base to see if there's any feedback about the retirement plan communication that went out, I think, August 19th. The letter was dated. Everybody should have got something mailed to them or emailed to them. If you don't know about it, I think that's also a good topic to sort of talk about, too, just to see if that communication was effective or not. All right, so with that, any other late additions? Seeing none, we'll move on. Are there any changes, additions, subtractions to the minutes from last meeting? Pretty short minutes. Mm-hmm. Is there a motion to approve?
Motion.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there any dissent? All right, seeing no dissent, that the minutes from the September 3rd meeting have been approved. So we'll go right into business of the day, if that's okay with you, Paul. We have Paul Streeter here with us. I'll let Paul sort of give his background, a little bio introduction to the group, and it'll be a conversation sort of with Paul presentation, but really not a formal presentation. The goal here is to understand the budget model. When we hear budget model, what does that actually mean? What is its impact on staff? So, you know, please be thinking about questions, and this way we can engage in a rich dialogue with Paul while he's here with us. We're glad that he is here and appreciate you being here. So, turn it over to Paul.
Great, thank you. And thanks for the chance to be here. I do want to just make this a conversation. I appreciate some questions were gathered beforehand and sent to me, and I'll just work off of those. But if you have others, you know, push me on it, and if we don't finish today, I'll gladly, you know, come back. So how much time do you want me to take?
30, 40 minutes?
Okay. So just a quick background. I've been at Cornell 28 years. Been in many different roles on campus. I started in cash management. I worked in internal audit for about 9 years. I was in human ecology for 4 years. Was in the budget office for about 9 years. I did a stint in CALS for a little bit. And then most recently, before returning to the budget office, I was up at the Vet College for 4 years. And so I returned to the budget office in this role in April. My history with the budget model is actually fairly deep, not just the last 6 months. When the provost wanted a new budget model, he kind of put the charge forth in 2009, I think it was. It was a six-month period we had. But I actually was in the interim vice president role, and myself and a colleague from engineering were the chairs of the co-chairs of the task force that drafted the original framework. So I can share a little bit of what we were thinking when we did it. The final adoption, it took, you know, about 4 years to get it finally adopted. Some variation from the original framework, but largely the same themes and certainly the principles we were trying for back then kind of held true all the way through. So I'll try to give you some of that context in my comments, because I think it's important for you to understand that. I'm going to work off the questions that I received and probably just change the order a little bit, but let me just get a sense. How many feel like they understand when we say, use the term new budget model, what that actually means? Does anyone feel like they're clued in or? Okay. And so let me, I've never attempted to try to explain it this way, but I'm going to make a shot at it. Because I think it's easiest to understand where we were to where we are right now. So let me go back to where we were, old budget model. Well, let me just define the term budget model. So a budget model is simply the way we're distributing resources on campus, revenues that come into campus, and how we're distributing costs. So who gets the money and who's paying what cost. The budget model doesn't affect how much cash comes in the door. It doesn't affect how much cash goes out the door. It affects who gets the money and who pays, you know, what bills that we control centrally. So the budget model, and then I'll jump to one of the questions toward the end that you put on up front. The budget model didn't change, didn't make worse, didn't make better the Cornell, you know, our campus financial situation. It didn't change it at all. It changed where it was felt, but overall it didn't create more money and it didn't spend more money. So it's just how the money flows. So with that as context, let me step back to kind of old budget model. And I'm going to describe kind of probably four different ways things were handled in the past. So let me kind of just show of hands. Anyone here from law school, Johnson School, or hotel school? Got one of them. All right. So law, Johnson, and hotel, they used to exist on a model that was called, they were called TUBS. I'm not sure what the term came from, but it's a common term in the industry. Just means that they kind of sat, is what the term was, TUBS on their own bottom. They got their money, though they charged students tuition, they kept the tuition dollars, they kept gift money, investment returns that were related to their endowments. Johnson Hotel and Law received that money directly, they kept it in their budget, and then they paid their bills. They paid their staff, they paid whatever expenses they had, and they paid a bill that would come from central administration to the colleges that say, here's your share of the budget office or the president's office, kind of general overhead of the university. So those three schools were almost the notion of a tub, and they're standalone businesses in some way. Not separate from the university, I don't mean to imply that, but they received their revenues and they saw all their expenses. They paid their light bill, they paid their building care bill, they paid their maintenance bill. So got their revenues, paid their expenses. They had their own checkbook completely. So who's here from the contract colleges, any of the four contract colleges? Vet, Cal's, IOR, and Human Ecology. Okay. So the model for those four colleges was different. They received a large amount of their money. They received all their tuition, so they enroll a student. That tuition dollar for every student came to the college. So for all four colleges, they got their tuition money directly. They got their investment returns. They also paid their share of university overhead. They paid their utility bill. They saw these bills and they paid them directly. Actually, utility bill, they saw them, but there was some money that was held centrally and paid on their behalf. But the colleges got a little bit of exposure to them. They knew that there was such a thing as a utility bill. They knew how much it was. And they could actually think about it. If we could reduce it, that would be a good thing. And it was in their consciousness. And they saw the overhead bill. So that's the four contract colleges. Slightly different, piece I left out on the contract colleges. The contract colleges receive about $130 million from New York State. So the term, when I use the term contract college, it's a nomenclature that we've developed internally at Cornell. It just denotes the special relationship that we have with the state of New York. So there's $130 million that comes to campus, $120, $130 million that comes to campus from the state of New York. It's taxpayer dollar support. Same way that SUNY Binghamton, SUNY Cortland receive state tax dollar support, we do as well. We're not formally part of the SUNY system, but those four colleges are actually separately chartered in New York state law. They're fully part of the university, as you all know. They're not separate institutions, but there is money that comes. That money came in one lump sum to the provost, and the provost decided how those four colleges got that money. A lot of history underneath that, so it wasn't that the provost was changing the amount every year. But in essence, the money came to the provost, and then the provost allocated out to those four colleges. So put those four colleges in terms of a budget model, they're a bit of a hybrid from where Johnson Law and Hotel were. Does that make sense so far? So now, who's here from architecture, art and planning, arts and sciences, and engineering? So those three colleges, we used to called general purpose colleges. And the way their money worked, they got an allocation from the provost. So all the tuition that came from those three colleges, you enroll a student, you get tuition, that money went to the provost. The provost got the tuition dollars, the provost got the financial aid bill, the provost got the utility bill, got the maintenance bill, and got the overhead bill for all of campus. The deans in those three colleges got an amount from the provost, net of all that activity, and they never saw that activity. They didn't know what the utility bill actually was for engineering or arts, for architecture, art, and planning. They didn't know what the overhead bill was. They got a net amount, and then they worked within that amount to fund the activities of their college. So much different model than the other two I described. And then if you're sitting in central administration, folks from central administrative units, so for those of us in central administration, we would get an allocation from the provost, and means it give us a set amount, you know, give the unit had a set amount of money to spend, and you'd live within your budget. And the way that money was gathered was a bill out to all these other units that I talked about. And I left out campus life, or folks in campus life. Same kind of thing, campus life, you actually, you know, you enrolled a student in the housing plan, the dining plan, you kept the revenue, and you got bills directly. So what I've described are four different budget models, and there's some other variations. I could go into facilities or IT, and there's some variations off of that. But I hope I just kind of illustrated. There was four different budget models. Now picture a room of the provost with the deans all at the table trying to make decisions on where do we go forward, particularly as financial times get tight. And you've got some deans who actually see their financial aid bill and can think about it, and can think about policy because they understand the relationship and the variability of it, and other deans who never see it at all. You've got some deans who pay for overhead costs of the university, and other deans that don't. So we had this mix on campus where there wasn't one story to follow. There wasn't one path of decision making or even conversation. So that's where we were. The provost tasked a group about 5 years ago to come up with a new budget model, and what he wanted was one common budget model for all of campus. So that was a box he put around. It actually was a really helpful box, but it was a defining box because we could only come up with one. So what that model is now is a bit of a hybrid of everything I just talked about. So tuition money for campus right now, and I'm going to try to describe the new tuition model, and I'm going to talk about it in terms of where does money flow, both in, as it flows into the university and then as it gets distributed and how we distribute bills. So just going down our main flows. Tuition now for undergraduate students all flows to the provost. So where before hotel, CALS, Community College, ILR, receive their tuition directly, they don't. It flows to the provost, and it goes into something we call a tuition pool. And all the financial aid costs for those students also go into that same pool. Provost gathers all that money, and on a net basis, so financial aid is, a good amount of financial aid is really just tuition dollars that we've reinvested in students. So some of it's gift money, but a large chunk of it is just tuition dollars that I'd use the term recycled back into to student financial aid packages. So this net amount, what's really new cash coming in the door, the provost receives, and then the provost distributes it out to all colleges who enroll undergraduates and who teach undergraduates. And there's a formula now in how that's distributed. We look at the average course enrollment. We look at first college of enrollment. So what college did the student actually enroll in? That factors in about 40% of the equation, and then 60% are based on where are those students being taught. So I didn't mention in the old budget model, you used to have money passed between colleges to pay for students. I thought, I'm in arts, I taught some engineering students, there's some money that would flow. But now all that money comes in to the center, and the provost distributes it out based on enrollment and based on teaching. And there's a formula that does that, predictable formula that units can rely on. State money, the provost, same kind of thing, it comes to the provost, pushes it right out to the contract colleges, but it used to be the provost kept the piece to pay for utility bills and maintenance costs. No longer does that, gives it all to the colleges. So the money flows directly to the colleges. For master's degree tuition or doctoral research degree tuition, that money flows right out to the colleges, wherever the students belong. So what I'm describing is there's more money that is pushed out to the colleges in general. Colleges receive all the revenues, and then they get all the bills. So all colleges now get their facilities bill, and they get it real explicitly. They get the utility bill, they get the building care bill, they get the maintenance bill. And again, before, it was a mix of how colleges got it. Three colleges paid directly, four colleges paid indirectly, the contract colleges thought, but they didn't actually pay it, and three colleges never saw it at all. Now it's explicit for everyone. trying to think what else is, and then everyone's paying an overhead cost of the university. So I've overhead, not meant to be a positive or negative term, I'm overhead. Folks that were, you know, we're not directly involved with students, any, you know, the support functions of the university, that's what I'm terming as overhead. The cost of our operations are billed out to colleges, but it's really explicit. So colleges now can see, and they understand what the budget office is costing, they understand what alumni affairs and development costs, what student academic services, et cetera. So what's happened is we've created a lot more, hopefully a lot more transparency. Yes, sir.
In terms of the tuition and formula distribution, is there any consideration based upon the cost to educate a student versus a major? So, for example, I'm sure it costs more to educate an engineer than it does a history student.
So right now, no, that is not. It's every student is valued the same in the formula. What essentially the pool does is it takes all that and it distributes every student, you know, the value of every student on the same basis. So there is no differentiation that says engineering cost, you know, the cost of education engineering might be different than it might be in certain, you know, certain parts of arts and sciences. So no, there is no adjustment for that.
Okay. So certain things might benefit more.
Yes. Yeah, the one balancing factor I haven't gotten to yet that I think kind of accounts for that, let me get to that. No, it's a great question, and I appreciate you asking it when you did. But I think I'll try to address some of that where I think we make up for it. So what we tried to do is create a model that makes the revenues much more apparent. People understand what drives revenue, and they can respond to that and think about behaviors. We were trying to align behaviors with decision-making with the resources so people could see the expenses, see the revenues, and understand how they relate. That was really the goal of the model. Does that make sense generally to folks? So in the end, then, this is kind of to the balancing. It's one way to distribute. It's not going to work for everyone. So not every college, nor did we want to create a system in which every college had to figure out how to cover all their costs based on their enrollment. I mean, we're one Cornell. It's not a bunch of collective colleges. It's one Cornell with different units. We've got this budget model so units are aware of revenues and expenses, but the provost provides lots of different terms around it, but I'm going to use the term subsidy, subvention. Subsidizes colleges, and we always will. There will be some colleges that, even when things really settle out on the budget model, and they're not yet, but when they fully settle out, there will be some colleges who likely always receive some money from the provost to support their operation, because if you took their enrollment, left their expenses, they would never make ends meet, and that's okay. We've got some colleges in which that dynamic of revenues less expenses is going to create a positive margin, and we've got others in which it's going to be negative. And again, that's okay, and the provost kind of plays the banker across that. The one element, how does the provost do that? The provost taxes tuition revenues. So where I said all the tuition goes out to the colleges, the provost actually keeps its taxes 10% of that tuition revenue, net tuition. So it's not the financial aid piece, because that an element that's not real cash. But the real cash in the door, the provost taxes 10% and keeps that internally. There's some endowment money that is kept internally by the provost. So the provost has a budget,
in which he or she would do this balancing and have money to invest in new initiatives. So what we don't want to do is have Cornell's strength comes in the ability to work across colleges and to have programs that are not it's not every slice. It's not a bunch of silos. We may think of it that time, but the strength of Cornell really is the collaboration that occurs across, and the provost needs some money to be able to seed that, to make that happen. And that's what this 10% tax right now, we call it the university support tool tax, but it's just, you know, in the long run, it's to provide some flexibility to invest in new initiatives and for the president and the provost, I'm saying the provost, through the president and the provost, to seed new activities on campus. We're not there yet, and I'll comment on that in a second, but that's what it's designed for. So in a nutshell, that's what's happened, is we've changed the way money to how they're received and how they're distributed back out.
Not being any gritty, but how does the medical college fall under that?
Medical college is outside of this conversation. So what I'm talking about is an ISCA campus budget model. Thank you. Yep. I'm sorry?
Geneva
is in this model.
Geneva is in this model, yep.
But Cornell Tech?
Cornell Tech sits outside of this model. So Cornell Tech, when Cornell Tech was formed, even though Cornell Tech is definitely part of the ISCA campus, it comes in through the provost here, strong linkages with engineering and CIS, but it sits outside this model. There's a hard line drawn just to make sure that they function financially, they meet it on their own and don't pull resources from Ithaca, nor do we pull resources from them. So yeah, this is an ISCA campus model. Thank you for the clarification, your question. Anything else I can just answer on the model, and then I'll kind of go into some of the impacts.
And even though we are doing doctorate students and not undergrad, so veterinary college receives some of that 10% tax for operating costs?
So veterinary college gets taxed 10% on DVM tuition, the professional degree tuition. So just to fine-tune on the 10% tax, it's actually not on research degree tuition. The business model, if you were around research, we don't actually earn a lot of tuition on research degrees. We charge it, but we often just, through fellowships, assistantships, lots of different mechanisms, we turn that into financial aid. So most research students don't actually pay cash to come. Some have external sponsorship, and some fall on, become carried by an external sponsored award. So those situations bring cash in the door, but in the scheme of the whole enterprise of research PhDs, it's relatively small cash. So we don't tax research tuition, but we tax professional degree tuition and undergraduate tuition.
Who determines, you mentioned kind of the overhead people's costs, who determines the percentage that comes to those groups?
How much we as a budget office, how much money I would actually get to operate?
Right. So instead, that all the colleges, unless I misunderstood, all the colleges pay a percentage back.
Yep.
To help cover that general function. Mm-hmm. How is that percentage that was set?
Yep. That's a great question. So the decision on how much a given unit, a given unit gets allocated, that's really the provost's decision and any kind of advisory groups that he or she has set up. So those are centrally decided. And then whatever that bill is, so all those, all that investment is aggregated, and then it's distributed out based on several different metrics. So some of it, the research-related costs are distributed based on everyone's proportionate share of the research enterprise. How much research are they doing? There's a set of costs that are distributed based on headcount. So costs that really are more people-oriented based on headcount. Some are based purely on students. So it's really around the student services. And that's even a finer line between all students and undergraduate students. So the vet college wouldn't be paying for career services operation, which is really around undergraduate, but all undergraduate colleges would be contributing for that. So there's a whole costing model that does that.
How does this model address what we're all fighting for, the employee rights as far as salaries, benefits, state versus endowed, or contract versus endowed? Does the budget model change any of that? as opposed to if you're working in Denver or Canton or anything like that versus a contract college?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, the budget model doesn't change any of that. What the budget model does, so let me segue a little bit then into, so let me leave that question, but let me give some more context because I think we'll help answer the question. As I said at the beginning, the budget model doesn't create new revenues or create new expenses. So it's neutral, if you will, in terms of how much resources we have as a campus. So in that sense, it doesn't change the compensation conversation. It doesn't change, any kind of investment conversation. What it does do is I think it brings the trade-offs clearer to light. So go back where we were when I said, I tried to describe we had four different budget models and tried to picture decision-making on campus of where do we invest, how much do we invest, how do we think about these issues. You senior leadership of the institution didn't have one common view of that, even one common framework to have that conversation, to talk about something like salary compensation or whatever. So now there's a common view. Those kind of go back to the financial status of the university and bring that into the picture. So we have been struggling, as everyone knows, the last several years, half dozen years, we've had financial challenges. We've made a lot of progress on them. We're not out of the boat on it. We finished fiscal 14, kind of the operating budget of the IFCA campus, at a break-even. We're a $2 billion operation on the IFCA campus, and our margin was basically break-even. Less than 1%, positive, but basically break even. So we continue to really struggle of getting any kind of space financially, and that's a different. I'm glad to go into that conversation, but that's a different conversation. The budget model doesn't change that dynamic at all. But what it does in terms of investments going forward, and whether that be compensation trade-off versus tuition dollars versus the endowment payout. Those are kind of three big policy issues that the trustees have to decide. What's the amount of tuition? How much do we pull out of the endowment to support operations? And what's the salary pools that are going to be authorized? Those are three big assumptions that will get decided in January this year by the trustees. It's a much clearer conversation, I think, for folks to understand what those trade-offs are around it. So, the budget model doesn't affect it. I think the budget model brings better clarity to that.
But in theory, wouldn't the transparency perhaps affect how some colleges push for how the movement of the money is going to be set? If, for example, central services, if they feel now that they see it, spells out, they feel, well, we really don't utilize those central services. We want it to shift with how that money is being flowed.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So that transparency, there's one of the questions was, so how's the budget model going? So let me write off of your question to try to answer that.
Yeah.
We're still in a rough state. It implemented in fiscal 14. So the year we're, fiscal 14, our year is July 1 through June 30. So fiscal 14 ended last June 30th. So we've had 1 year under our belt, and we're now in the second year of it. How's it going? People are still trying to understand it. So people, including just, bodies like the Employee Assembly and then, broader just constituents across campus, faculty, staff trying to understand what is this thing. They hear a lot about it. So I think we're still on that learning curve. This kind of dialogue's great. We're definitely on that learning curve. But even from folks who, for the deans, the unit administrative officers, business officers, the vice presidents understanding what this means and what does transparency. There's a good side of transparency and there's a bad side of transparency. I don't think the bad's really big, really significant unless we behave badly. And where you start behaving badly is if you take this budget model, it's meant to be a reasonable distribution of resources and a reasonable distribution of expenses. There's no exact science out of this. We could have changed the metrics. The provost went from allocating tuition in fiscal 14 based on 25% based on enrollment was the formula last year and 75% based on teaching. First year implementation, that you might imagine that starts incenting units to teach a lot more. The more we teach, the more money we're going to attract. And it starts creating an internal competition that's not healthy. And it's not what the intent was. So, the provost tweaked it and said, this year we're going to a 40-60 model. You go from 25-75 to 40-60, it makes some major shifts on where the money is. You can imagine Arts and Sciences, a college that teaches every student on campus at one point. Something that de-emphasizes the amount of teaching hurts a budget for Arts and Sciences. Now, as the provost made those changes, he's worked to hold folks harmless through this budget model. So, units have been held harmless in fiscal 14 and fiscal 15 through these changes. So, they might see revenues in one way, more or less, but the provost has come on the backside and given a subsidy to kind of hold folks harmless so that, overall, the change through this, folks haven't been impacted yet. We've got to stop doing that, or it will lose its meaning. But through this kind of transition state, the provost is holding folks harmless. So this transparency, it can create incentives and behaviors both between organizations but within organizations. We've seen units who will take the overhead bill and say, well, we got this based on number of employees, so now I'm going to distribute it to my department based on number of employees. And that's never what the intent of the model was. The model is a reasonable distribution of revenues and a reasonable distribution of expenses. It's not an exact science. And to the extent we start behaving in a manner that is an exact science, or something close to that, we start creating incentives and disincentives and, kind of a local optimization that's not healthy for the institution. So how's the budget model going? We're seeing some of those behaviors that we've got to work to tamper down, because that's not what's there. So it's natural stuff as people understand the implications of it. It's nobody behaving badly. It's just that we're trying to find the sweet spot on this thing. All the budget models, it's about finding the sweet spot where you're focused on what you really should be focused on, which is how much money's coming in the door and how much money's going out the door, so we can invest in program, what are the priorities, not kind of an internal competition. But so we're working through that. So budget model, I'd say we're learning those things. Everyone's still learning the budget model. We'll be better after this year that we're in now. People have a year under their belt, see how it works. We'll understand it better, be able to articulate it better. So it's still, I would say, a work in process. It's firmly in place. But what it does is, so I do want to kind of come back a little bit to the question on compensation, but frame that in terms of overall financially for the university. As I said, we're balanced on the IFTA campus, but just barely. On a $2 billion budget, we're about $2 million to the good. $2 billion, I don't know if I said $2 billion. A really, really, really small margin. A little bit of change in financial aid, a little bit of change in utility bill, and that dynamics were not positive. So the scale of the number, the big numbers are big, lots of zeros at Cornell, but don't let that scale fool you. We're in a really tight spot. I talk about the provost budget. The provost budget is in deficit. So there's a dynamic between what the provost has to allocate and what units all have to receive. And through this process, we've had a deficit in the center for a number of years. That's been part of this challenge campus-wide of trying to get out of, improve our financial position. We remain in deficit. We're making progress. But sorting this out, and it's actually gotten a little bit, in short term, it's gotten more complex with the budget model than less complex because of kind of these hold harmless subsidies. But, it will sort itself out. But financially, we remain kind of, challenged on campus. So the trade-off conversation, coming back around to compensation, the budget model doesn't affect it. I think the clarity, to your point on transparency, does affect it, because I think we now understand trade-offs for the long term better. We got into our financial, I believe, we got into our financial difficulty partly, not solely, but partly because nobody on campus could really see all the money. And the decision makers are incented from a different standpoint. So you could, I
by no means, since we're sitting here, I'm going to pick on this building for a quick second, but I don't mean to pick on any player. Please don't interpret this in any way. But the cost of putting up physical sciences, which is, you know, largely related to College of Arts and Sciences, in an old budget model, that would largely be supported from the center because the revenues would be received by the provost. So if there's debt, you know, to help pay for this building, that debt would be paid by the provost. So a dean could advocate without having to think about how does he or she pay that bill. If you were the law school and you're putting up addition, you've got to think about how you're going to pay that bill. And again, I'm not saying good, bad, anything. It's just different perspective of how the money was received. And so to be making decisions on campus about major investments without a clear picture financially, I think hurt us. So that's where, personally, I'm a big fan of the budget model. I think the transparency will help over time because I think it just sharpens that conversation and makes sure that we stay within our means.
Yes. Have our peer institutions experienced other things? I mean, we're coming up on 150 years
yep. at
Cornell, right? I mean, it seems like a long time to have that happen to now get to a point where we have to change the way we think about money and the distribution of funds.
Yep.
You know, so is this a theme in higher ed right now?
Yeah, so folks are all over the place. There are some folks that, if you read literature on it, there's the term would be, I don't believe this is where we're at, but a common term is responsibility center management. So profit centers, cost centers, but the term that's around it, if you Google responsibility center management, it means is, you know, your own, whatever entity, whatever organization exists, you get your revenues and then you live within your means. And so several institutions, University of Pennsylvania is one that's a lot of press about it, probably 20 years ago, went to what's called an RCM, Responsibility Center Management Model. There's other institutions that have gone there. I don't know the industry well enough to say what percentage. But, you know, there's this dynamic. Is it good or bad? I think finding the sweet spot for your institution. I view what we're at as probably a bit of a hybrid, and we're at a hybrid partly because of the relationship with New York State. But just to illustrate kind of the complexity, so the response to the question about tuition distribution, and I said we value all students the same, but remember, all students don't pay the same. In the contract colleges, there's resident tuition and non-resident tuition. So students, there's a $16,000 discount in the tuition price for resident students in the contract colleges. So how do we do a tuition model that says that student gets the same value in it? Well, we took a piece of the state appropriation and put it in the tuition model. So there's a kind of a true-up that happens so that the provost has everyone, you know, valued the same. And it was actually what we thought on the task force, the only way we could get to a single budget model. My guess is no other institution in the country has that dynamic, certainly not to the scale that we do. So, but this notion of making more transparent the relationship, making more visible and conscious the relationship of our activity to the revenues in the door and the expenses that then follow, and making that a more broader distribution responsibility about that, that's mixed. And it's more, probably more prevalent in the more decentralized an institution you are. Yes, sir.
Paul, something you haven't really touched on, but I would think would be very impactful in the model is not all space is equal. A lab with, we're doing some stuff this morning with lots of fume hoods,
yep.
is a more expensive space to operate than my office. How does that get metered out across the campus?
Yep. So right now it gets metered out. Utilities get paid on an actual basis. So most major buildings on campus, major and even most minor buildings on campus are separately metered. So utilities can actually see what's the cost of physical sciences, what's the cost of Toboggan Lodge, what's the cost of the Vet Med Center, et cetera. So they're separately metered and it's billed that way. Maintenance costs, because maintenance, building care, those costs certainly would differ by the type of space. That's done in the model on it's more socialized. So it's facilities kind of says, we've got X amount of square feet. This is what our workforce is to take care of it, if I take building care, for example. And they've developed a metric that is a bit broader level than actual usage. It's kind of how they distribute their workload, and that's how the bills get distributed. And then if you go to preventive and routine maintenance, maintaining air handlers, maintaining elevator systems, things of that sort, that's very socialized, in which facilities knows what it takes to take care of the campus, and we've divided that by a square footage amount on campus, and everyone kind of pays in a real, very socialized manner. So I think it's kind of 3 degrees of how facilities costs are done. And then how does it get, recognize that difference? This is where this whole harmless comes into play right now. It's not clear that even though engineering, might carry a really high cost, their tuition might not be enough to cover it. We go back to the day before this budget model, we were in a certain financial position, and the budget model didn't change that. So the provost subsidy is in play now and will be forever, I think, to keep those things in balance. So the goal isn't to, the goal is to recognize the cost and then think behaviorally, how do we reduce the cost where appropriate? How do we save energy, et cetera, and to incent that, but not to create a dislocation because of it. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before, it's all about transparency, so you're starting to see patterns emerge, especially like the cost of educating one student versus another. What are some other things that you see now that you've been in the budget model for a little bit of time? What are other things that are coming up now that things are more transparent?
I think the trade-off, the trade-off decisions for folks, so thinking about how do we, what if we're going to build a new building, what's that cost of space and how are we going to pay for that? And so I think that becomes a much crisper discussion. I think trade-off of new programmatic investment. The question of who's going to pay for it, and if it's really a collaboration between 3 colleges, then maybe just those 3 colleges should focus on that. So I think what's happened is there's been a crispness in the conversation around investment. And the other thing that has happened, I think it's incented entrepreneurial behavior, which was one of the things that it's desiring to do. So if you think of a program and you recognize the revenue is going to flow to you, then and you can make it work financially, you're incented to do it in this model. So discussion about new programs, Joanne DeStefano, who's the CFO, she made the comment just a week ago to me. She was in a setting with a bunch of deans. It was just an informal setting, but she said that informal conversation was much different than she had ever heard it, because there was a broader group of folks who were thinking entrepreneurially. Now, whether that be about new revenue or saving money, but people were thinking about the business aspect of the enterprise in a healthy way. I mean, I think it could be unhealthy if we focus too much on it, but in a healthy way of how do we make it work and how do we improve it. So I think that's really sharpened, and I think it's broadened.
My question is, the Red College will be undergoing renovation. So, but that was all kind of planned before the new budget model. So does the new budget model change how money for the construction?
So construction money, let me separate. The cost of operating that building once it's built,
mm-hmm.
The budget model doesn't change it for the Vet College too much, because the Vet College is already seeing those kind of costs.
Mm-hmm.
But those costs would be borne by the Vet College. So if the utility bill goes up or down, Vet College bears that building, care, maintenance, et cetera. I haven't talked at all about construction money, capital money. So the budget model didn't really deal with the amount of money we have for construction. So that's outside of this model. A large amount of stuff for the contract colleges and for the vet buildings coming from the state of New York, and that's really outside this model because it's coming from external.
Yeah.
But it does affect, it's a moderate effect on the Vet College because of what history was. Put that same question in architecture, art, and planning, it'd be dramatically different. The Milstein Hall, for example, was right on the brink of this budget model change. They were in the midst of the Milstein Hall came online during the financial crisis, but not during the budget model change. The college, before the budget model change, had to sign on to paying the utility bills for all that. So they were a little bit of a transition state. But all units now would think about that, and they think about their space that way, because they got to carry it forever. There was a question down there. Yes, sir.
What's the new budget model? And the age of the I feel like
like there's a lot more influence that that college might have with admissions in terms of tuition, because a lot of it is going through that tuition, like students actually getting in. So with the new budget model, do you believe that any sectors or staff, like i.e. people who do admission, might be getting added stress points to their jobs with this new model and the drive to make a class?
I don't think, I don't think so. Let me just stick with admissions, and I'll give you a full set of thoughts that were running through my head quickly. I don't think so. So once tuition comes into the center now, and actually the whole financial aid bill comes in the center, the old model, it was mixed. We had some units, so the architect, art planning, engineering, arts, never saw the tuition, never saw the financial aid bill. So when they admitted, when they recruited a student, you tried to build the Canada pool, and they thought about a student, no financial incentive in that whatsoever, other than to optimize the class and maximize the size of the class for academic, you know, goals and purposes. So not so much for financial. So now that financial is more apparent, but the money still comes to the provost, as does the financial aid bill. So if I'm a college that wanted to recruit in a certain area because I'm going to get, you know, less needy students, just think about what could happen in the admission environment and where the incentives could be of where you recruit students, because that might affect the need. Those incentives have been removed in this business model because financial aid socialized. So I think in that sense the budget model doesn't change it. What I think now does, though, and where I was hesitant when you first asked the question and tried to think how to reply, sensitivity to enrollment is much more apparent to folks. So I do think there is a, whether that creates pressure that goes out into the admissions staff, I could see it somewhat doing that. I don't think directly, but I think for, again, deans to be thinking about what are the implications if we under-enroll, it does have implications. I do think, I guess it's a mixed reply. I do think it does, but probably not quite as direct as I first interpreted your question. I think all these things, again, I think that more people are aware of it. I think it's creating tensions in the system. And my guess is it's why, you know, a body such as this is probably really concerned about the employee. Is an employee assembly really concerned? Because you probably hear about the budget model an awful lot. There was one of the questions, what can you take back to your constituents? I'd say a couple things. One is patience. And two is separate out the budget model from financial challenges, because they're two different things. And we are still dealing with financial challenges in the midst of the budget model. So whatever happens on the compensation front conversation, or whatever happens on, you see a layoffs put through the college because of financial challenges, people will blame the budget model. Understand it, not the budget model. We are in the same financial position we were before. How those things may have been, you know, communicated before would have been different. We just would have taken a cut on, you know, if we were in a hole, the provost would cut, the arts and sciences budget. It wouldn't be called budget model, but the same effect would have happened. Arts and sciences would have less resources, and it would trickle, you know, through the system as they give less to departments, et cetera, et cetera. So things will get blamed on the budget model that really have to do with our financial reality. And I think the quicker as a campus we understand there's a difference between the two, the better off we're able to actually understand what our challenges are and how do we make progress. So I'm going to stick up here for a quick second, and I'll come back to you. There was questions over here.
Just a quick question. With respect to the administrative units, has the new budget model affected them if they weren't generating revenue, and you said that those monies came from a central allocation anyway?
Yeah, so financially it has not. With the budget, the central units have been affected because of the budget challenge.
But not because
of the budget model. What central administrative units feel, so if you're within a central unit or if you talk to a colleague in a central unit, they feel like this transparency is a bad thing, because now everyone knows what does it cost, you know, to run the budget office, and I could have Dean saying, what are you doing? Why can't you guys do it for less?
Right.
So whether that's a good or bad thing, I personally think it's a good thing. I think we should be challenged. But so I think the dynamic of the question has changed, but the amount of resources that I get as a unit or your unit gets as a unit hasn't changed due to the budget model. It would change because, you know, we've got to take a budget cut.
Right. Thank you.
So then I'll come here and then I'll come around tail. Yes, sir.
Sorry,
there's two questions.
Just out of curiosity, so alumni affairs and donations or funding that we get, like third floor of city assistance to remodels based on donations, is that totally outside this budget model? Or is the provost involved in, you know, money we get from alumni and then put into our college?
Yep. So gifts flow directly to the unit, so it's outside the model. Yep. Same thing with investment, you know, endowment return from payout off the endowment, so investment return, investment income, same kind of thing. Yep, very, very localized. So the incentive is there for you to maximize, you know, optimize that locally.
Is there no tax on that?
There's no tax on it.
10% from AAD. They're indirect cost equivalent, that
gift. Yeah, that's always been there. There's no change in the model, but it's an indirect cost equivalent on restricted gifts. Yep. But that doesn't flow to the center in any way. Yep.
Can I just throw in as an aside to that? Does that potentially mean that there could be like individual colleges and their development units potentially taking, I don't know what the right word is, but like land grabs for specific donations for specific projects?
Yeah, so there's always historically been challenges within Cornell of who gets what donor and who gets to make the ask of which donor. Development's mastered, they've managed that with the deans and programs, they're very good at it, or else we wouldn't be as successful as we are. But there's that tension that is inherent. If, we've got a spouse in my college, and you've got a spouse in your college who's going after that, that partner, those partners, that's been in the system, and that still gets managed by AAD with everyone. There was a question here, and then I'm going to come around.
So, a point of concern, now that we're operating leaner, whether it's budget model or not, we've plugged a lot of holes, and we've eliminated a lot of staff. Now there aren't opportunities to take appreciation of all the benefits that are extended to us, like education or something. I wouldn't dream of taking a class during business hours anymore, you know, at this time. Is there anything that's going to come about other than an improvement in the economy that more staff may come on so that we're allowed to take advantage of benefits that are extended to us?
So there's a lot in that question. It becomes really localized because there's differences across campus on the ability, the capacity of folks to be able to free themselves, you know, during the day from work. And that varies by unit, independent of the budget model, but definitely related to financial situation, a unit where someone's feeling stressed. So the long term, if the inability to do that is driven because of less staff due to financial, unless financial improves, there's going to be some tension there. Campus-wide, no change in policy, and there wouldn't be. We actually have done some stuff. So CC, your question is just to highlight some of the continuous attention on the budget model. CCTS, so Children's Tuition Scholarship, used to be a direct bill to units. We actually now in the second year of the budget model, because that's something we don't want units thinking about, anything around that creates incentives locally to encourage, discourage, you know, promote the benefit. So we've now socialized that. We got it out of a direct bill so that what happens in the vet college versus hotel just happenstance each year, and there's no incentive, you know, within the unit to either promote or not promote benefits. So I would say the budget model's got to be careful not to create local incentives, but the financial challenges are going to create challenges in actually being able to, everyone be able to benefit from that. So no change in policy on that front, but it's going to be experienced differently across campus. Yep, I'm going to go, if I could go work up from Alan and then this way.
I was just going to make a couple observations from the board point of view. Really detailed and excellent observations itself. In terms of the new budget model, without weighing in on it, whether it's great or not great, the board is very pleased with the transparency idea. It's something that the board would, the board is full of financial people who review budgets and work on this and call out for their day job. So they have been very pleased to have a model that is more transparent and they can really understand with the contingencies and not knowing where costs are, where income is going. It's a good feature. That can be done in any number of ways, but the way we've done it is really effective and a good model for transparency. On the construction end, as Paul said, that's a different kettle of fish, but the board also has certain policies regarding when and how a building can be erected, constructed, materially enhanced, and improved, or having an addition on it, or farming, or whatever it can have. So there are certain relatively new safeguards in place about the financing and of the new building, where we will not be in a position where we're assuming debt for those new buildings. And so that's another board decision. So at that level, certain safeguards have been put in place, and just want to mention that in connection with one of the conversations that we've been having.
If I could just write off of that for a quick, again, a takeaway I think important for you to understand, and then, you know, takeaways, I think you'll hear about it. Construction on campus is not funded out of the operating budget for the most part. So you look around here and see the crane there, that's not coming out of tuition dollars. That's coming out of gifts. And those gifts are restricted. So we, you know, I do get questions, I know President Provost get questions, you know, continually, is how can you be short of money when you're putting all this building up? So recognize that it's not, the money's not fungible. So we didn't get a gift dollar to pay for, you know, someone's salary. We got a gift dollar to put a building up, and we can't use it for anything but that. We get money from the state of New York, the Vet College Project. It comes for specific projects. I won't say all, because that wouldn't be true, but most construction activity, and certainly the majority of the dollars that you see on campus are external monies that are restricted. You'll see units do lab renovations, smaller stuff that they got to do just to maintain the facilities or create it so that it works, you know, repurpose something for a new program, for a new faculty member, for students, whatever. That kind of work, that might be coming out of operating budget. But that's gone through, you know, a scrutiny at the local level where a department head, a dean, whatever, are saying this is really important and I'll make this trade-off versus that for this short term because it's so important. But generally on campus, because there's a lot of construction activity and people kind of get confused, how can we be doing all this and then be claiming tight financial situation? It's different pots of money and they can't come together. We wish they could, but they can't.
But once the building is up, then those costs, building costs now get tuition dollars. So,
absolutely.
So how does that work when departments, you know, I want to give a gift, I want to give you however many million dollars to build a building, and development is great, we're going to build a building, but then it falls on the department or the college operating costs.
So that's why I think the budget model helps us in the long term, because before the dean or the program head says, I really want, you know, a big building out there, I got to be able to pay it. They have to think about that equation. And there's steps in the system that requires them to put a business model, and we're strengthening that. We're strengthening it actually as we speak. This fall, we put new guidelines out that raises the bar on that. And units will have to put a business model that myself, Joanne DiStefano, they have to present it, test it. We have to see that it's new revenue in the door. It's not that Arts is going to pay for that by taking students from engineering, because that didn't change our financial position on campus. So I think the model kind of incents us to be more attentive. It enables us to be more attentive to it. So historically, we haven't been good at it, and hopefully this sets us up to be better.
My question is about how this budget model affects campus-wide. I believe there was some changes there that maybe some other people didn't feel. If I'm not correct, previously, the old budget, they were not required to make donations into the financial aid pool. And now they are.
Yep.
But on the other hand, they haven't been able to raise their housing rates or dining rates, and that's all, just like it is with tuition, you know, it's all by the trustees and what they approve. How is that, you know, little piece there? That seems like a little piece, but it's not really a little
piece. It's a big piece.
And then on top of that, you have quite a bit of late maintenance and deferred, you know, things. When we're having the parents come in and you know, the opening, you know, you kind of cringe that because, you know, the college is going to start pouring in.
Yep.
And I don't know, was there an additional put into that pie,
so let me try to explain that. So this is actually one of the things, again, that I think this conversation's made more transparent. So I don't think folks really think about it, but if we raise, the way the math really works on it, if we raise housing and dining rates, think about it, overall as a campus, we lose money. And we lose money because we only house half the student population, roughly. But housing and dining are an element of the financial aid formula for all students. So if we increase housing and dining programs, that cost, the cost of those programs, not only go into the financial aid formula for students who are actually living on campus, it goes in the financial aid formula for students who are living off campus. And given that we only house, you know, about half the student body, when we do that, we affect financial aid for all. And we're then, in turn, are giving financial aid out into the local community. We're not keeping that money internally. That's real cash out the door, because that's money students are using to pay landlords, to pay, you know, go buy food at Wegmans, et cetera, et cetera. So what's become, you know, in the transparency, what's been recognized is that we've got to be thoughtful about when do we raise housing and dining rates and how much do we raise that, because it's going to put pressure on another part of the university that was never recognized before. So that's kind of what's going on that front. I don't think that what we're doing right now is sustainable in the long term, but in the short term, we really needed to recognize it and think about it. The provost has in turn provided some support back to student academic services, though in this notion of hold harmless, the fact that we haven't allowed an increase in the rate, costs have still gone up that would normally have been covered by an increase in the rates, and the provost has allocated money to cover. It's not to cover the facilities costs, so there's definitely been a downturn in the amount of resources available around maintenance, et cetera, but the provost has provided money to support increase in salary costs, an increase in food costs, you know, general operational costs, but the facilities cost, he is not. Again, it's not sustainable, but it's where we're at the moment.
Right, I think the current tension is that part of the transparency is not happening down at the level of the employees. And all we're hearing is that we have to do more with less people because of the new lifestyle.
Yeah, and I guess that's the part I'm hoping you take away from this a little bit. You do more with less people, not because of the budget model.
Yeah.
So now you get to an isolated thing for, you could say, for student academic services. Well, it really is, because then we would have got our rates before. But we would have been in a hole in the center, and the provost would have cut something that probably would have trickled its way out. I don't think, again, we can find pockets where you can point to, yes, it's the budget model, but that's going to be little pockets. And in the end, I really don't think it's true. Might have taken a little bit longer to play itself out. But the challenge is, and I, you know, the do more with do less, I don't like that, but I know that's how it feels right now and what reality has been. We've got to find a way past that. But that's not because of the budget model. It's because of our financial situation. The budget model didn't create more revenue and didn't create more expense. And I challenge anyone to refute that. It created no new dollars on campus and no new bills out of campus. So it didn't change the overall picture. How it got distributed on campus, yes, it changed, and everyone's feeling the pitch. You could go to, you know, all the colleges on campus who do less on the maintenance front as well. It's more readily apparent and visible, I think, in the student life arena, but I don't think it's unique. But I don't think that's well understood.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
In the interest of time, it is 1:20. If there's
Sorry.
Any quick last final thoughts or questions, I didn't mean to cut anybody off. If anybody wants to ask anything, everybody good? Okay. Any wrap-up call that you want to have? Or I think, you know, one thing for us, you know, is there any way that we can help? We can partner with your office, help get that message out? Because I think to to Bridget's point, there are a lot of the folks that, you know, maybe don't have it trickle as far down to them, because I think some of that messaging and some of the phrasing that you used today is good for employees to hear. You know, sort of, so what's the, is there a PR push from your office or from the provost to sort of reach the corners of campus? And if not, is there a way that the employee assembly can help do that? And that's something you don't have to answer today. You can take back and think about.
No, it's a great question. To is there? No. Should there be? Probably. And I think that's, a partnering with the assembly on how to do that. So I guess it's an open invitation from me to you. Pull me in, and I will think about how to, you know, push in, if you will, and engage. But I also encourage and ask whether it's just more dialogue here for your understanding or however you think it's best to do it. But I'll gladly, you know, talk about this wherever. Whatever. I think the more people understand it, the better. But so I'm willing to do whatever you all think would be best appropriate. You know the channels better than I do. And I'll participate in whatever way, but I'll also keep it in mind.
Great.
Yeah. I do think that is the problem, that the average staff and employee is just being told, oh, the budget model, budget model, budget model. And with the tools, if we can draft something, then it would assist in general.
Yeah. Well, good. Thanks, Paul, for being here. I hope that was as informative for everybody as it was for myself. I really appreciate you taking on the time. I know it's a busy schedule for you, and probably every time of year is busy for everybody, but yeah, we appreciate you being here. So thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So Will, I don't think Linda is here.
Just a quick update.
But if BJ has that, we'll skip the report from the chair. And
Linda, again, is just, she's got the food ordered, so she just wanted to confirm if anyone had any kinds of objections to it, but roughly 300 turkey sandwiches, there's vegetarian, ham options, so it looks like everything's covered. The food will arrive around 11:30. She's also looking for volunteers, so I'll circulate something for that, just help distribute the food before and after the event as well, too. So just keep a lookout for that. And again, Linda did a lot of coordination for this, so please help her out and just volunteer some time before and after the event to help distribute things.
Actually, the food is strictly after.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the food is coming from Cornell Dining. Sorry, I misread. It says the sandwiches are arriving at 11:30, not the people. Sorry. So yeah, it's from Cornell Dining. So
it's very, very similar.
Very similar to what we've done before.
Oh yeah, that was kind of odd, wasn't it?
We can talk about that. I think that's, you know, something that should fit into sort of the communication plan around it.
Okay.
If it makes sense, I know we can talk about it here. We can have the communications committee work on that or the executive committee, however we want to do that. If folks feel strongly, happy to hear sort of that opinion or thought now. But if folks are sort of indifferent to that, then I think we can try to decide what's best moving forward.
Yeah, we did. We had it, we tallied it up last time, but it was very unofficial because we had those sheets,
sure,
and then we sort of averaged out what we did. I think not the same way we did it, because that was certainly haphazard.
Yeah, if there's a real purpose or information or desire to seek out, then absolutely I think it is, but I don't know if we have that. So if folks have ideas, I think that's sort of where we're at right now.
Could we get the whatever those results are to make sure that we're maximizing however
we would have presented at one of the meetings afterwards, so I can look through my notes.
Eric, do you have those results? Yeah. But if you could take a look and see if you have those, that'd be helpful. Do we have all our UA slots?
No, we don't. And
CIC?
I have another meeting. I did send out, so a quick one. I gave you some time to sign up for those subcommittees. I only had Nancy come up with her sign up. The communications committee, you are automatically one of the subcommittees. We're going to go with BJ's Viximas, unfortunately. Since I haven't heard from a lot of you as to the subcommittee from the three that we all worked on at the EA retreat that was focused us. Remember that last email where I said please? So I'll start tuning out some victim appointments soon. The sign-up information, those that passed by the EA table that showed interest in coming, all of them have been contacted as well with all the spots to hopefully fill. No one yet has come back in concrete. So, again, I apologize, but if you're not going to tell me what you'd like, then I'm just going to pick and choose and do any, meeny, miny.
So we have... I would hate to get to that point because
I know.
There's two spots on the campus infrastructure committee, and there's some really great issues that they're going to be addressing this year. The UA and Jim have put together an outline where meeting schedules are set, and it makes sense from a.
When do they meet?
So the campus infrastructure committee is going
to
meet.
All the standing committees meet 4:30 to 6 on Tuesdays.
And that was
okay. The first meeting is the 23rd, but it's 2 weeks off of the main UA meeting.
So that is a significant problem for lots of people.
That was.
That is your barrier. Yeah. Because I can tell you, I can't do things that that's.
Yeah, I had people pull out. And when the minute I told them that.
That's the biggest burden on staff.
I wanted to be in UA, but it's exactly.
I've had people say, I have interest, give me the details, I've communicated with you, give me the hours, and everyone's like, no, can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the. One out of the four constituent groups there, there's never an ideal time, you know, because this time, which may be convenient for the employees, is not going to work for the students or graduate professional students.
Then you rotate the meetings and you try to, you know, have one earlier in the day and then the next one later so that at least you can qualify.
Would you be able to do that?
We'd have to look at it. There are a lot of problems with the constituents. 4:30 to 6 is the kind of the blackout period for Cornell. Where there aren't classes, it's a stated period for these types of things, and every other hybrid we've tried to deal with has not been sustainable. We've lost more than just the employees. We've lost across from the faculty and GPSA and SA. So I understand the difficulty.
Yeah.
And you are the most impacted group because a lot of employees also come in earlier, leave later. However you fill your billet, our first meeting for all the committees is the 23rd, and I'm concerned because now agendas have gone out to the members that have been appointed. So if you get appointed from today to the afternoon of the 23rd, let us know, get the word to so we can get you the materials and you know where the meeting is, and you don't miss that first meeting, because the 23rd is letting us set agendas and organization, and that's the one, it helps to be at that one right from the get-go.
And this is one of the three. The other two we have completely staffed with employees, but this is one of three that we don't have staffed. And all the other two are meeting at that time. So if someone can, you know, think more, if they want to be involved in the Campus Infrastructure Committee, that would be great. Or know anyone.
Yeah. As a risk of sounding like a martyr, I live on campus and I don't have kids, so I could probably go.
Welcome!
Yeah!
One down! So in the interest of time, we can take this offline. I'll turn it over to Tanya if she...
Okay.
I can bring it up next meeting. It's not a...
Okay. So we can move that to next meeting. I can table my comment there. Anybody have anything else they'd like to add? At 1:29, is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Yes, I
second. Second. Any dissent? I see none. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Greg, very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.